Thank you very much for your, well, your gracious extravagance in overstating the case. And as long as Rabbi Haskell Lichtstein has spoken so well and so glowingly of tradition, I want to tell you that if it does deserve any applause and any acclaim, it's because there are such fine writers for it. An example would be Rabbi Haskell Lichtstein, who in the last issue of Tradition published a very splendid article on the mitzvah of tefillin. I'm grateful to the chairman of the convention for having invited me to address you tonight on this very significant theme of how the synthesis has been achieved. This assignment has given me personally the opportunity to re-examine more closely and more thoughtfully what to my mind is one of the most consequential issues of our day in the Jewish world. Because the question of synthesis and its success is not and should not be of interest only to the rather circumscribed circles of rabbinic alumni and the Yeshiva University administration. Factually, synthesis is the prevailing mood and the guiding principle of modern American orthodoxy, and the question of its success is therefore of much more than parochial concern. 75 years may not be much in the biography of a great university or a great yeshiva, but it is long enough to provide a clue to how well it has succeeded in fulfilling the original ideas, aims, ambitions, dreams, and hopes of its founders. The word synthesis represents the most unique and original of the ideals of Yeshiva University. I'm not going to quibble over the word itself, whether or not it's the most felicitous term that we could have discovered for the particular idea represented. This quibbling is best left, I hope you all remember, it's best left to Yeshiva University sophomores as a stuff for their endless and perennial debates. I do want to address myself to the substantive issues represented by the word. Has it in fact been a success or a failure? Two answers are immediately pressed upon the objective and innocent investigator, representing the two extremes, each in its own way dogmatic and unequivocal. There are those who insist that anything less than pious self-gratulation, in a manner calculated to pass a public relations test, is a perfidious betrayal of yeshiva. And there are others who, with all their loyalty to yeshiva and concern for its welfare, suffer from a kind of institutional masochism, and perversely, it seems, enjoy a kind of endless, captious, devastating criticism of yeshiva, and project only the blackest and most melancholy future for us. I do not believe that the truth lies with either extreme, with either group, with the hopeless optimists or with the desperate pessimists, with those who offer only applause and those who can offer only jeremiads, or, if you're going to excuse a tortured pun, with the rah-rah boys, or with those who in Hebrew are always crying rah-rah. I will go a step further. I also do not believe that the truth simply lies somewhere in between. Moderation may be good as a policy, not as a bias in objective and honest analysis. In order to find the answer, we must first formulate the problem properly. Exactly what do we mean by synthesis? And again, I'm not going to quibble over simple semantics. I'm interested rather in the ideational content, in the philosophy that informs this term. What, in short, is the theory of synthesis that has in the past and can in the future articulate with the rhythm of yeshiva's expansion and growth, and then its activities, meaning, purpose, and dignity? There are, I submit, two different theories of synthesis that diverge from each other in significant ways, even as they share certain common fundamental principles. They are best represented by two great Jews, both of the modern world, one West European, the other originally East European. They are Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch and Rav Kook, both of blessed memory. Hirsch was one of the giants of German Jewry, and I believe he deserves more recognition than he has been getting from us. As a leader and an educator, he was eminently successful, personally responsible for the flourishing Denkglaubigkeit, or enlightened orthodoxy, that survived him to this day. Thoroughly Jewish, also a completely modern Western man, he aspired to bring about a harmony between, or we would say to synthesize, the two traditions and outlooks of Judaism and the Western civilization. He tried to formulate a Jewish humanism, demonstrating that the humanism so popular in the Europe of his day had Jewish roots. Hence, his superman, the ideal Jew, whom he called the Yisrael Mensch, a combination of Yisrael and Mensch. And hence, too, his great educational program of synthesis under the slogan of Torah in Derech Eretz, meaning by Derech Eretz, of course, Western culture or secular civilization. Torah and wisdom, according to Hirsch, were not regarded as deadly enemies, placing upon us an either-or choice between them. It is true that he gave Torah primacy over secular education, if a choice had to be made. But from his critique of the Rambam and Lahavdil Mendelssohn, who approached, according to Hirsch, who approached Torah from without, from his development of his own what is called his autochthonous or indigenous attitude to Judaism, we get the impression that Hirsch believed in the original identity of Torah and secular disciplines, which now appear to us, but in different form. One cannot speak, therefore, of an essential conflict between them, because essentially they're the same thing. From this, however, we must take the next logical step. If no conflict is essentially or theoretically possible, neither can there be any dialogue, any meaningful dialogue between them. They can cooperate, even as the limbs of the body cooperate and coordinate, but they cannot interact and speak to each other, even as a sane and balanced person does not talk to himself. Hirsch does not say this explicitly, but it is, to my mind, an inescapable conclusion, and one that I think will appear more significant when we contrast it with that of Rav Kook, which I shall discuss shortly. The synthesis of Hirsch is pleasant, harmonious, charming, and even creative. The secular studies, on one hand, help us in understanding Torah more deeply, and on the other, Torah tells us how to contemplate nature and listen to history. Considering the long estrangement of Jews from secular studies since the golden age of medieval days, and the unhappy record of the relations of religion and science in European history, this was a courageous attitude and a refreshing approach. His stature must therefore be assessed from this background, as well as against the contemporary isolationism of East European Jewry. Hirsch tried to show, in the words of his translator, Bernard Drachman, who was a rabbi in New York in the early days, that, quote, Orthodox Judaism was not maintained solely by the superstitious or narrow-minded older generation who had never been initiated into the science or the culture of the age. And yet, it is precisely a statement of this sort that makes us wonder about the sufficiency of the Hirschian interpretation of synthesis for our own day. For Hirsch and for his contemporaries, it was important to produce a westernized Orthodox Jew in order to refute the charge that Judaism is a collection of old superstitions. For Drachman, in the America of his day, a college education and a PhD were social necessities, lest the Torah Jew be classified as narrow-minded. Now, I will grant that our public image is not always the best. And newspaper reports, especially concerning Israel, very often make Orthodoxy look sick. But certainly, we have progressed beyond the stage where we have to prove ourselves, where an English-speaking Orthodox rabbi with a BA is a unique phenomenon. Or take this statement by Hirsch himself, and you'll feel the temper, if not the contents, of his particular brand of synthesis. I quote to you. Pursued hand in hand, there is room for both general and Jewish studies, each enhancing the value of the other and producing the glorious fruit of a distinctive Jewish culture, which at the same time is pleasant in the eyes of God and the eyes of man. Unquote. Hirsch seems to be delighted that he can avoid those intellectually bloody battles between religion and science, that he can steer clear of the ragged edges of discord between Torah and Western wisdom. Hand in hand they will walk and appear pleasant in the eyes of all. There is something placid as well as idyllic and utopian in this vision. It is a bit too easy, too gentlemanly, too cultured, or if I may say it without being snide, too bourgeois. I do not think that the slogan Torah im Derech Eretz would be appropriate to the synthesis envisioned by Rav Kook, as it emerges primarily from his Oros HaKodesh, the first volume, and from his very superb and courageous address at the opening of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Torah with Derech Eretz, or secular wisdom, implies that they keep a respectable distance from each other, like neighbors who remain courteous as long as they do not become too intimate. Torah and Derech Eretz would be more fitting for the Kook version of synthesis, because there's a difference between both terms, just as, for instance, there is a difference between strawberries and cream and strawberries with cream. There are other such examples that one can give. Torah and Derech Eretz means a meeting of two powerful personalities, the two of them coming to grips with each other, with a very serious question of whether this engagement will be an embrace or a wrestler's headlock. For Rav Kook, the educational problem is treated in a metaphysical frame. The categories with which he operates are those of Kodesh and Chol, and the issue transcends, therefore, the demonstration that orthodoxy is not narrow-minded or superstitious. Rav Kook speaks of two tendencies of the Jewish spirit. One is directed inwards. It's a ha'amaka. It's a deepening of the sacred, and is represented by the traditional yeshivas. The other is an outward one, relating the within to the without, just as the intensification of Kodesh is embodied in the old type yeshiva, so is the relating of the sacred to the secular that stands without, the function of the university. Today, of course, we must forgive Rav Kook if, despite his courageous criticism and the warnings he issued so clearly and lucidly at that time, he allowed himself the extravagance of imagining that the Hebrew University would fulfill the lofty mission he assigned to it. But you know that hindsight is always wiser than foresight. His analysis, nevertheless, remains valid. It is the second tendency, the centrifugal, or from within to without motion, of the sacred to the secular, that is of utmost consequence to us. The merging or synthesis of Torah with wisdom is not meant to make up for some lack, some original want in Torah itself, but rather to create something new and original in the world of the spirit through this combination. Rav Kook tells us that the sacred is not antagonistic to science, but first he reminds us that it is the sacred that is mechayeh et hakol, that vitalizes everything. It is that which gives life to the secular disciplines themselves. Kodesh and Chol are functionally and indissolubly related to each other. The sacred, I'm sorry I didn't bring the Hebrew along, but I didn't know if I have to give this for publication immediately or later, so I have to quote some translations. The sacred, he says, must be established on the foundation of the profane, a yesod hachol. They are related to each other as matter to form. Secular is the matter, the sacred is the form. And the stronger the secular, he says, the more significant the sacred. Just as the body must be healthy in order for the spirit to flourish and flower, so secular knowledge should be first rate if the sacred is to benefit. Now, this intimate relationship between sacred and secular is given the strongest expression when our cook writes that the Yesod Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies, comprises both the elements of the sacred and the profane. This implies a very significant notion which our cook later states explicitly, that there is nothing absolutely profane or secular in the world. There is no absolute metaphysical category called Chol. There is only the holy and the not yet holy, waiting impatiently, as it were, for the holy to bring it across the border and to change it into the Kodesh. I might mention incidentally that this cook vision of synthesis is the exact reverse, the exact antithesis of modern secularism, which will recognize Kodesh as long as it remains insular and doesn't go out of its own bounds. Now, Cook's centrifugal Kodesh, the going out, is so overpowering and outgoing, one might almost say extroverted, that the profane therefore loses its absolute character even before its encounter with the sacred. It is as if it were fated from the moment of its creation to submit to the sacred. Now, having denied the absolute character of Chol, does this imply a blurring of the Havdalah, of the distinction between Kodesh and Chol? The answer is emphatically no. And allow me to repeat to you a homily, a drush, that I quoted in my recent article in Tradition. The Shulah HaKadosh asks, when Havdalah we say, Amadu ben Kodesh v'chor ben Or l'choshech ben Yisrael amin ben Yemesh v'ili sheshet mei ha'maseh. He says, I can understand the relevance to Havdalah, Saturday night, of the Havdalah, of the distinction between Or l'choshech, Kodesh l'chor, and Yom HaShvi l'sheshes Yemei HaMaaseh. But how does the Havdalah between Yisrael Amin come to this particular occasion? And he answers very wisely that there is a distinction between Yisrael and the Amin and how they understand the Havdalah between Kodesh HaChol and Or l'choshech and Yom HaShvi l'sheshes Yemei HaMaaseh. The Amin, the Gentile mind, can conceive only of an unbridgeable gap, an absolute dichotomy and dualism. Kodesh on one side, Chol on the other, and never the twain shall meet. Whereas the Jewish conception, the Yisrael conception, is that there is definitely a Havdalah, but the Havdalah is made only so that the Kodesh can intensify and strengthen, that it can jump across the gap and take the Chol, embrace it, and therefore sanctify the Chol itself. It is not a permanent division. It's not an absolute dualism. It is only created in order to be fused or bridged later on. This, I believe, is how Rav Kook conceives of the relationship of Kodesh and Chol. There is a Havdalah, so as to allow for the intensification of the sacred in its centripetal or inward motion. And this itself is a prelude to its outward or centrifugal movement, where it reaches for the profane and transforms it into the sacred, a transmutation for which it has been waiting from the moment God created it. The fact of Kodesh leads to the act of Kiddush. Now, I hope that my brief survey of both Hirsch and Cook have given you some idea of the similarities on one hand and the differences on the other as I see them. Both men and the Weltanschauungen they represent are most relevant to our day and to the shaping of our own destiny. Each represents a different version of the synthesis which is the major purpose of our yeshiva. Hirsch, the aristocratic pedagogue, and Cook, the poetic kabbalist, both inspire admiration and deserve our undying gratitude. Yet basically, Hirsch is the cultural thinker and the practical educator, while Cook is the metaphysician and the mystic. Hirsch's synthesis is one of coexistence, and hence essentially static. Cook's is one of interaction, and hence dynamic. Hirsch is an esthete who wants Torah and Derech Eretz to live in a neighborly, courteous, gentlemanly fashion. Cook is an alchemist who wants the sacred to transmute the profane and recast it in its own image. From the point of view of Cook, it is not enough to raise a generation of Orthodox Jews who will also be cultured Western men, admirable as this ambition may be. It is not enough to bear the two cultures as parallel poles, which like all parallel lines, can meet but only in infinity. It is urgent that there be a confrontation and an encounter between them. As long as there is no encounter, there is no true difference between the amount of time designated for each discipline, sacred and secular, by the Reform Sunday School on one hand, or the Yeshiva Yeshiv Lev de Satmar on the other extreme, or Yeshiva University in between. When Kodesh and Chol are severely departmentalized, unrelated, and merely coexist in splendid isolation from each other, there is really no valid excuse for wasting any time on secular studies. State law, economic necessity, or social needs are not an answer sufficient to define a consistent philosophic position or to defend against the serious charge of Bittul Torah. In the Cook version of synthesis, there must be a qualitative accommodation of both studies. For the secular studies are not, by no means, inherently or eternally unholy, and the Lamudei Kodesh are sterile and frustrated unless they have something not already sacred to act upon. From this point of view, the Lamudei Chol are part and parcel of the drama of Kiddush. With Hirsch, whatever interaction there is lies in the direction of the profane to the sacred. Chol helps Kodesh. That is, the secular disciplines are employed to order, to define, to rationalize, to assist the sacred and place it perhaps on a firm scientific basis. For our cook, who demands interaction as a central theme of synthesis, the motion goes in both directions. The less important one is the one that Hirsch wants, and that is the rationalization, explanation, or the adornment of the sacred by the profane. Cook, for some reason that is rather mystical, calls this a right-to-left motion. Far more significant and consequential is the left-to-right motion, and that is the radiation of Kodesh towards Chol, ennobling it, raising it to the loftiest level, sanctifying it, impregnating it with meaning and purpose, so that whatever interaction between Kodesh and Chol the Hirschian brand of synthesis will inspire will be something like, well, for instance, using chemistry to determine how to apply the laws of Hilchos Taruvos, or using mathematics to help you in a problem of determining the luach and settling a question of Kiddush HaChodesh. Good enough. But the dynamic relationship demanded by a cook synthesis emphasizes something more, and that is the use of halacha in defining for the chemist or the mathematician himself how to shape his approach in the secular life, his purpose, his significance to the world, the meaningfulness of his ostensibly profane tasks. It requires the mastery of Torah so as to teach the Ben Torah how to grapple with the mundane, stubborn issues of ordinary life and make them yield to the light of Torah. The encounter of Torah and wisdom has as its goal, in his words, to create in the world new souls and give life a new, thriving, throbbing, healthy form. In a word, Hirsch's Torah im Derech Eretz aimed for bringing both disciplines together in one person, whereas Cook's Kodesh Chol dialogue strives to bring them together in one personality, in shaping it, inspiring it, vitalizing it. Well, now to get down to earth, we may return to the question assigned to me. Has the synthesis been achieved? Have the ideals of our beloved yeshiva been successfully realized or not? 75 years ago, in the conditions that prevailed in this country, synthesis, even of the Hirschian type, was a utopian, wild, audacious dream. It was the kind of idea which practical, hard-headed men dismiss as a pipe dream, and which pipe dreamers are much too impractical to implement. To hold forth this synthesis as an ideal was an act that demanded courage, vision, and guts. Today, after three quarters of a century, we may say without hesitation that yeshiva has satisfactorily passed the test. Yeshiva and synthesis are no longer a dream, no longer an experiment. American Orthodoxy today, despite all its well-advertised faults and inadequacies, and who knows it better than we, is substantial, thriving, and full of promise. And all the sniping at yeshiva to the contrary notwithstanding, American Orthodoxy today is a realization of yeshiva's philosophy, for it is cast in the image of yeshiva, not that of Lakewood or Spring Valley. Smicha plus a college education is now the ambition of many yeshivas who formerly looked upon such aspirations with undisguised contempt. And that wasn't 75 years ago, it was in our own day. If Hirschian synthesis, or something like it, was the ideal of yeshiva in this first or this past epoch, and frankly I cannot see how, given the conditions of our society, anything but a Hirschian type synthesis could have been the first goal, then the major part of American Orthodoxy, and not only the official graduates of Yeshiva University, is living testimony of its realization. Yeshiva has produced not only individuals, but a whole community of people who live Torah and Derech Eretz. Considering the vicissitudes of these past 75 years, the upheavals, the uprootals, the immigrations, the Holocaust in Europe, the state of Israel, economic growth, social mobility, the intellectual displacements and scientific revolutions, such an achievement can be classified only as heroic. But if the past must be declared a success relative to the goal of a Hirsch-type synthesis, to my mind the future requires a transcending of these ideals and a striving for a Cook-type synthesis. It's a far more difficult task, far more dangerous, far more uncertain. Because Cook's dynamic conception affects personality rather than mere coexistence of one person, I believe we must now begin to work on chosen individuals rather than only on a broad public scale. For a Cook-type synthesis, we must begin to concentrate not so much on a horizontal expansion as upon a vertical deepening of scholarship, the development of singular thinkers who, steeped in Jewish learning and especially halacha, will be able to sanctify the profane, which they will know with equally thorough scholarship. More intensive grounding in halacha and gemara, more penetrating scientific and humanistic scholarship, perhaps no less than these, a new emphasis on the philosophic disciplines, especially the later authentic Jewish thinkers, to provide the conceptual framework for the dynamic synthesis. These, to my mind, are the most elementary requirements if the next 75 years are to be as successful in achieving a Cook synthesis as the first 75 were in achieving the Hirsch kind of synthesis. I think we have some living examples in our midst to inspire such a development. Our own beloved Rosh Yeshiva, Dr. Belkin, who especially in his recent book, In His Image, succeeds to such a great extent in formulating a philosophy of personality as it emerges from the data of our halacha, our great teacher, our beloved teacher, the Rav, who personifies Rav Cook's challenge, Lahashkif Gam al Hachol, Mitoch Haspachlaria Shel Kodesh. They are excellent illustrations of the kind of dynamic synthesis for which we must begin to strive. Of course, the fact is that these two people are not themselves products of Yeshiva University, although they represent its ideals. But if in the future we can so orient our labors and our efforts, strengthening all forms of scholarship, introducing above all an exciting religious spirit into the walls of the yeshiva, encouraging all forms of creativity, then, although I believe we cannot afford to wait another 75 years, we may yet succeed in capturing the elusive prize of a dynamic synthesis. If the yeshiva, to my mind, can produce in the future just one Belkin, one man who is both a Rosh Yeshiva and a scholar in the secular disciplines, and one Soloveitchik, it will have been eminently successful. For to produce one such, it will already have given birth to a host of lesser lights who will represent in varying degrees the vision of Rav Cook. Now before closing, I want to direct several remarks to the tensions that beset the yeshiva, especially our alumni and our administration, and which are ever present. I wasn't here until late this afternoon, but I'm told that it was present at this convention too. Which are ever present and are never really brought out into the open completely. At the risk of sounding like a bull in a china shop and walking where angels fear to tread, I wish to comment on the undercurrent of criticism and the reaction of annoyance with it that all of us are aware of. I refer especially to the tension surrounding the question of whether yeshiva is living up to its ideals or abandoning them, of whether it is taking off in the right or the wrong direction. All of us must realize that criticism given in the right spirit is an indispensable concomitant of synthesis of any variety. Not only criticism by one party of another, but general anxiety and tension, torturing doubt and perplexity, all these are necessary and unavoidable side reactions of synthesis. Listen to Hirsch in his 19 letters writing to his fictitious young friend. Quote, "Do not think our time so dark and helpless, friend. It is only nervous and uncertain, like a woman in childbirth. But better the anxiety that prevails in the house of a woman about to give birth than the freedom from anxiety, but also from hope and joy, in the house of the barren one." Unquote. These words of comfort and encouragement strike home to those of us, all of us, who are concerned by the constant self-examination and the aggravation of critical self-evaluation by our own colleagues, ourselves, and the B'nai Yeshiva. They are to be interpreted as signs of creation and birth. And if they were not there, the child of 75 years of labor might be stillborn. Rav Kook too speaks of synthesis and the accompanying anxiety in similar terms. Rather interesting. He quotes the prophet Yeshaya, "Ufachad v'rachav levaveh." Pachad on the one hand, fear, and on the other, nachas, joy, v'rachav levaveh. The dynamic synthesis of Rav Kook is fraught with danger and with risk. Pachad is inescapable. The centrifugal motion of Kodesh, the sanctification of the profane, suffers from a historical ambivalence, which we've experienced many times in our long history. As for instance, when it appeared in the controversy surrounding the translation of the Torah into Greek. Whenever there is an encounter of sacred and profane, there must be pachad. For who knows but that instead of the Kodesh converting the whole will master the Kodesh, as in Anatole France's famous story Thais, which the Rav is so fond of quoting. If it is security and freedom from fear that we seek, then we must withdraw into our hermetically sealed ghettos, or else vanish into easy assimilation. But if we wish to relinquish neither world, and even allow them to act upon each other, then we must accept pachad, and the sense of crisis, and all the neurotic tensions that come with it. Whoever is genuinely concerned with the destiny of our people, and the fate of Torah and our yeshiva, will tremble at the risks inherent in this kind of synthesis, even while acknowledging that it is his holy duty to undertake it. There are many human casualties that have already resulted. We know them only too well. And I fear that there are many more yet to come from this historic program of synthesis. Rav Kook was not troubled by this phenomenon. On the contrary, he reminds us that those who approached in history the encounter of Kodesh and Chol without Pachad, they were failures. And most of their descendants were assimilated and are no longer identified with the Jewish people. Only if there is Pachad can there be hope to experience the second part of the prophet's verse, V'rochav levavech, true joy and nachas. If yeshiva is beset by various internal tensions, it is the direct result of the creative efforts of the Hirschian synthesis and the pachad of the secular sacred dialogue of the Kook synthesis, which I think hopefully is beginning to appear already a little bit in our yeshiva. The critics and the criticized, the tense and the nervous, all must realize that this very pachad is proof of a healthy ferment of life, of activity. The wonder is not that there are tensions. The wonder is that yeshiva has not yet exploded as a result. The presence of pachad is therefore a good sign, as well as a cause of anxiety, and one in which all of us must recognize a debt of gratitude to to our distinguished president, who in his loneliness, and I don't envy him one bit, bears so much responsibility for the future of Yehadus, and who must direct the creative efforts of synthesis and designate and choose the fields on which the encounter will take place. If I may, just for a moment, say that those of us who criticize, and I think that frankly all of us criticize because we're normally intelligent people and we have our critical faculties, but we must be very much beware of overstating our criticism. The Mira Mashgiach, Ibiruchim, Zechrono Levracha, once asked, we read in Parshas Noach, and I think I'll be the first speaker today to proceed beyond the first pasuk. We read that God destroyed the entire world except for Noach because of Chumas. Chumas, according to Chazal, was Gzela. When he asked a very simple question, one half the world stole from the other half. So punish those who were Bazlanim. What do you want from the victims? Why kill them? And he answered with great insight. He said that according to Chazal, the Chumas, the Gzela, was Pachas Mishavah Pruta. Less than a penny's worth. But the outcry of the victims was as if they had been robbed of $1 million apiece. And that overstatement of protest, that over-criticism, that over-complaining, more than the Pachas Mishavah Pruta, that was Gezela too. Because they were stealing from their other Gazlan his rights, his feelings, his sensitivities, his just claim not to have been a Gazlan more than a Pachas Mishavah Pruta. So that criticize we must, criticize we should, but all of us in that moment of truth when we are with ourselves and try to imagine what we would do if we were at the top, have to temper the criticism, not deny it, just temper it, so as to make the criticism proportionate to what we want to criticize. And on the other hand, we ought to encourage the administration to look upon this criticism and these tensions as coming not from outsiders, chas v'chalila, but from insiders who bear the deepest love for Yeshiva and directly and personally for its president. The very presence of this tension is a good symptom, a sign, an indication that synthesis is being fashioned and being formed and it's being achieved. Were this pachat suddenly to vanish, I would resign all hope for the future. Because the most effective release of all tension is death. And the absence of all criticism would be the ultimate and most deadly criticism of Yeshiva University and proof of its utter failure. It is a hard fate to live with ceaseless, constant, endless pachat. But it is a glorious and brilliant destiny that beckons to us, despite all the risks and all the dangers. We have, I submit, successfully achieved the first level of synthesis. We must now concentrate on the infinitely harder task of reaching the second level. The greater the earnestness, the dedication, and the loyalty we bring to our mission, the sooner will God grant that we experience also the consolation of the Navi, V'rachav L'vaveh.